A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's in the US right now, driving around, and he says the thing that hits you almost immediately is how much of the country is organized around the car. Not New York, not the dense cities, but the enormous stretches where the landscape is a grid of highways and malls, where retailers cluster together in pods, and where owning a car is just a background assumption. Rich or poor, fancy car or old car, everybody drives. And his question is, if we went back before the automobile, how different did rural environments actually look? When people didn't go to Best Buy and Trader Joe's as separate trips, what was daily life like? He's also wondering whether travel being so much harder meant communities were less connected, or whether the truth is more paradoxical. Maybe deliberate travel and not sitting in sealed metal boxes meant people actually had stronger local bonds.
That last part is the thing. The car didn't just replace the horse as a faster horse, it reorganized space itself. And once you see that, the whole question of connection gets more interesting.
So let's roll back the clock to a time before the internal combustion engine reshaped the map.
The first thing to understand is that pre-car rural America wasn't empty wilderness with isolated cabins. It was a dense patchwork. Small towns, farms, crossroads, hamlets, all spaced so that most people were within a day's walk or a short horse ride of some kind of commercial and social center. The general store, the blacksmith, the church, the one-room school. These things clustered at crossroads, and around them farms spread out, but the town center was almost always within a few miles.
A few miles on foot or by horse, which sounds close until you remember what a few miles actually meant.
A horse-drawn wagon averaged 4 to 5 miles an hour. So a 10-mile round trip to town and back, that's half a day. You didn't just pop out for milk. Every trip was planned, scheduled, and usually combined multiple purposes. You went to town on Saturday, sold your eggs or your grain, bought supplies, picked up mail, got the plow blade fixed at the blacksmith, and caught up on every piece of news that had accumulated all week. One trip, 5 purposes.
The weekly trip to town was basically a social media refresh.
That's actually not a bad way to put it. And the general store was the platform. It wasn't segmented the way Daniel's describing. You didn't have a separate store for electronics and a separate store for groceries. The general store was goods and gossip and mail and political argument and the bulletin board where someone posted that their cow had calved and they had milk to trade. All in one room.
And the physical infrastructure. What did the roads look like?
Dirt, mostly. Dirt that turned to mud in the rain, which meant travel was seasonal and weather-dependent in a way we've completely forgotten. There were some improved roads, turnpikes, privately funded toll roads in the early 19th century. And there were corduroy roads, which were logs laid side by side across swampy ground. If you've ever driven on a washboard gravel road, imagine that but made of logs and mud, and you're in a wagon with no suspension to speak of.
Sounds delightful.
The railroad was the exception. It connected towns to each other and to distant markets, but it didn't connect farms to towns. So you had this two-tier system, long-distance travel by rail, local travel by horse, and the gap between them was the wagon ride to the depot.
So the pre-car landscape was organized around a hierarchy. The farm, the crossroads hamlet, the market town, the rail depot city, and each level had a different function.
Right. And the market town hierarchy is worth dwelling on. Farmers traveled weekly to the nearest market town to sell goods and socialize. That's where the county fair happened, where the livestock auction was, where you went to see the dentist who came through once a month. The rhythm of rural life was built around these scheduled gatherings. Travel was deliberate, as Daniel guessed, but not because people were more virtuous. It was deliberate because it had to be. The cost of a trip was high enough that you only made it when it counted.
Which meant every trip counted. That's the part I think we romanticize, but also the part that's genuinely different. If you're going to spend half a day going to town, you're going to make it worth it. You're going to talk to people. You're going to linger.
And the horse itself shaped all of this. The Smithsonian's coverage of the horse and buggy era makes this point really well. A horse isn't a machine. It's a living creature that needs daily care. Feeding, watering, grooming, shoeing. That care created interdependence. You couldn't just park your horse and forget about it. You needed a blacksmith, a livery stable, a vet. You needed neighbors who could watch your horses when you were sick. The transport system itself was a social network.
Whereas the car sits in the garage and asks nothing of you except money.
Until the battery dies. But yes, the horse demanded relationships. The car demands a parking space.
So let's get concrete. A typical farm family in the 1890s in the Midwest. What does their week look like?
Monday through Friday, work on the farm. Saturday, the trip to town. Supplies, mail, selling whatever's ready to sell, maybe a haircut. Sunday, church. Church was huge. It wasn't just worship. It was the weekly gathering where you saw everyone. After church, people stood outside and talked for an hour. Potlucks, picnics, weddings, funerals, all of it happened within a few miles of home. And then occasionally, a few times a year, a longer trip by rail for something big. A wedding in another county, a trip to the city to buy furniture, a visit to relatives.
And what about the people who didn't farm? The town itself?
The town was the service layer. Blacksmith, general store, livery stable, harness maker, maybe a small hotel near the depot, a doctor if you were lucky. The town existed to serve the farms around it. And because everyone came to town for everything, the town center was where you ran into people constantly. You couldn't walk two blocks without seeing someone you knew.
Which is the exact opposite of the segment in travel Daniel's describing now. Drive to Best Buy for electronics. Drive to Trader Joe's for groceries. Each trip in a sealed box. Each destination a separate building surrounded by parking.
And the parking is the tell. The parking lot is the architectural signature of the car era. A general store from 1890 has a hitching post out front. A Best Buy has 400 parking spaces. The building itself is set back from the road, surrounded by asphalt. The whole thing is designed for cars first, people second.
You walk from your car to the store. You walk back to your car. And you've interacted with no one except maybe a cashier.
And the cashier might be a screen now. So, the physical landscape changed, but the social landscape changed with it. And that's where Daniel's paradox really bites.
Let's get to that. Were rural communities less connected before cars, or more connected but in a different way?
Both. And this is where most coverage gets it wrong. The misconception is that pre-car rural communities were isolated and disconnected. The reality is they were tightly knit locally but informationally narrow. You knew your neighbors deeply. You knew who was sick, who was feuding, whose barn needed painting. But your world was small. You might go months without meeting a stranger. News from outside came filtered through newspapers that arrived by rail, and through traveling salesmen and circuit preachers.
So strong ties, weak reach.
The car flipped that. It expanded your reach enormously. Suddenly, you could work in the next town over. You could join a church or a hobby group 20 miles away. You could date someone from a different county. Your network of possible connections exploded. But the depth of your local ties thinned. You stopped seeing your immediate neighbors as much because you didn't need them for everything anymore.
The car made neighbors optional.
That's the phrase. The car made neighbors optional. Before the car, you needed your neighbor to help raise your barn, to watch your stock, to lend you a harness when yours broke. After the car, you could buy a new harness at the farm supply store 12 miles away. You didn't need the neighbor, and so you didn't know the neighbor.
And the built environment reinforced that. Let's talk about the highway system.
The Interstate Highway Act of 1956 is the hinge point. That's when the federal government committed to building 41,000 miles of limited access highways. And that didn't just connect cities, it bypassed towns. The old two-lane roads went through Main Street. The new interstates went around, so the through traffic that had kept small-town diners and gas stations and hotels alive just vanished overnight.
The Main Street died so the interstate could live.
And then, the malls finished the job. In the 1950s through the 70s, shopping malls rose on the periphery of towns, where land was cheap and parking was plentiful. They were explicitly designed as car-centric replacements for Main Street. Climate-controlled, privately owned, surrounded by parking. And the general store, which had been the social anchor of the pre-car town, had no equivalent. The mall wasn't a place you lingered to talk. It was a place you drove to, bought things, and drove away from.
and big box stores after that. The Walmarts and the Best Buys and the Trader Joe's all clustered in pods along the highway, each one a separate trip, each one designed for volume and turnover, not for conversation.
And zoning laws locked it in. This is the part people miss. The car-centric landscape wasn't an accident of the free market. It was a policy choice. Zoning code separated residential from commercial from industrial. You couldn't build a corner store in a residential neighborhood anymore. You had to build it in a commercial zone, which meant you had to drive to it. Single-use zoning made the car a requirement, not a convenience.
So the system built itself around the assumption of car ownership, and then car ownership became a background assumption. As Daniel says, you can't participate in the economy without a car in most of rural and suburban America.
Right, and there's a name for this. Automobility. It's not just the cars, it's the entire system. The roads, the zoning, the parking requirements, the insurance, the licensing, the cultural expectation that of course you drive. It's a system that makes the car the default, and everything else the exception.
And it was a choice. That's the thing I want to underline. The U.S. chose this. It wasn't inevitable.
No, and the international comparison proves it. Europe and Japan had cars too, obviously, but they didn't reorganize their entire landscape around them to the same degree. European towns are denser, older, built before the car, and they preserved walkable centers. Public transit remained a real option. Japanese cities are famously transit-oriented. The result is that you can live in a European small town without a car in a way that's almost impossible in an American small town.
And the U.S. had the space to sprawl. That's part of it. When land is cheap and abundant, the pressure to stay compact is lower.
Plus federal subsidies for highways rather than transit. The 1956 Act put enormous public money into roads. Transit got crumbs. And the auto industry lobbied hard. General Motors and the other manufacturers had a direct interest in making sure the car was the only game in town. There's a whole history there of streetcar systems being bought up and dismantled.
So the landscape we have now is the result of specific decisions made by specific people in the mid-20th century, not the natural order of things.
And that's the most important thing to understand. The car-centric landscape feels inevitable because we were born into it, but it's contingent. It's one possible world among many, and it came with trade-offs.
Let's talk about the trade-offs. What did we gain, and what did we lose?
We gained reach, unquestionably. The car gave rural people access to jobs, education, healthcare, and social networks that would have been unimaginable a century ago. A kid growing up in rural Iowa in 1920 had a very limited set of life options. A kid growing up in rural Iowa today can drive to a community college, can join a robotics club in the next county, can date someone 40 miles away. That's real.
We lost depth. The casual encounter. The running into someone on the street. The knowing your neighbors because you had to.
Robert Putnam's Bowling Alone stuff is relevant here, though he was writing about a broader decline in social capital. The car is one piece of it. When you drive everywhere, you don't have the sidewalk encounters, the bus stop conversations, the walking to the store and stopping to chat. Those small interactions add up. They're the glue of community, and they're almost impossible to engineer. They just happen when people share physical space.
The car didn't eliminate community. It changed what community means. It made community less about place and more about shared interests. You might not know your neighbors, but you know everyone in your regional model railroad club.
Which is a real form of connection. I don't want to romanticize the past. Pre-car rural life was hard. It was physically exhausting, medically precarious, and socially stifling in its own way. You couldn't escape your neighbors. If you didn't get along with someone, too bad, you saw them every Sunday at church forever. The car gave people an exit. That's not nothing.
The flip side is that the car also stranded people. The people who couldn't drive. The elderly. The disabled. Children. The poor who couldn't afford a car. In a pre-car town, an elderly person could walk to the general store. In a car-centric town, an elderly person who can't drive is housebound.
That's a profound point, and it connects to the knock-on effect Daniel was asking about. The car didn't just change how we travel, it changed how we relate to place. Before the car, your place was your world. You knew every field, every creek, every shortcut. After the car, place becomes a blur. You drive through it at 60 miles an hour. You don't know the names of the roads you take. You know the chain stores, which look the same in every state.
There's a real loss there. A loss of what the writer Wallace Stegner called the sense of place. the deep embodied knowledge of a particular landscape.
The car made landscape interchangeable. A Walmart in Ohio is identical to a Walmart in Texas. The highway exit looks the same everywhere. The sense of being in a specific place with its own history and character erodes.
The answer to Daniel's question, were communities less connected, is that they were differently connected. Stronger local ties, weaker long-distance ties. And now we have the reverse.
The physical environment reflects that. The pre-car town was built for the human body. Walkable, compact, everything within reach. The car era town is built for the car body. Spread out, segregated by use, connected by asphalt.
The town itself became a machine for driving.
Once you build it that way, it's very hard to unbuild it. The infrastructure is sunk. The zoning codes are entrenched. The cultural habits are ingrained. You can't just add a bike lane and call it done.
Though some places are trying. The walkable downtown revival movement, the new urbanists, the people fighting for mixed-use zoning. There's pushback.
There is, and it's real, but it's upstream against a very strong current. The car-centric system has enormous momentum, and in the U.S., it's still the default for new development. Most new housing is still being built in car-dependent subdivisions on the suburban fringe.
Daniel's observation about the background assumption of car ownership is exactly right. It's not just a preference. It's a structural requirement. You can't opt out without paying a steep price.
The price is paid most heavily by the people least able to afford it. The teenager who can't drive yet. The elderly person who shouldn't drive anymore. The family that can't afford a reliable car and lives in a food desert because the grocery store is 6 miles away and there's no bus.
The pre-car general store was a social anchor. The post-car big box store is a commercial transaction. That's the whole story in one sentence.
The transaction is efficient. I'm not going to pretend it isn't. You can buy more stuff, more cheaply, than at any point in human history. The big box store is a marvel of logistics. But it's not a community. It's not a place where you linger and talk. It's a place you get in and get out.
The church is still there, of course. In rural America, the church remains one of the few surviving social anchors from the pre-car era. But even churches have consolidated. The little country church with 40 members closed, and everyone drives to the big church in the county seat.
Same with schools. The one-room schoolhouse is a museum piece. Kids ride buses for an hour each way to consolidated schools. The school is no longer a neighborhood institution. It's a regional facility.
The pattern is consolidation. Everything got bigger and farther apart. The general store became the supermarket. The local school became the regional district. The main street became the mall. And the car was the enabler of all of it.
The car was also the enabler of a new kind of freedom. I keep coming back to this because I don't want to sound like I'm writing a eulogy for the horse. The car gave people, especially women and young people, a mobility that was liberating. A farm wife in 1910 was pretty much stuck. A farm wife in 1960 could drive to town, could get a job, could visit friends. That's real.
The car was freedom, and the car was fragmentation. Both things at once.
Which is why the paradox is the right frame. Daniel's instinct was good. The truth isn't that we were more connected before and less connected now. The truth is that connection changed its shape, and we're still figuring out what that means.
The built environment is the physical record of that change. You can read the history of American community in the layout of the roads and the placement of the stores.
The pre-car landscape was organized around the human body and the horse's body. The post-car landscape is organized around the internal combustion engine and the parking space. Everything else follows from that.
To answer Daniel's question directly, pre-car rural environments were denser, more walkable, more locally integrated. Travel was harder and more deliberate. Communities were strongly connected locally but isolated from the wider world. The car reversed that, and the built environment was completely reorganized around the new technology.
The reorganization was a policy choice, not a natural evolution. The Interstate Highway Act, single-use zoning, federal subsidies for roads over transit, industry lobbying, all of it pushed toward the car-centric landscape Daniel is driving through right now.
When he's sitting in traffic on a 6-lane arterial, surrounded by Best Buy and Trader Joe's and Applebee's, he's looking at the accumulated result of a century of decisions, not an accident.
That rewiring has a human cost that's easy to miss from the driver's seat.
1994. I spent a summer cataloging dead general store sites for a county planning department in rural Ohio. The job was to photograph boarded up buildings and interview elderly locals about what those stores had been. I drove a county car, a Ford Escort wagon, and I put 11,000 miles on it in 3 months. The stores were all the same shape. Two stories, false front, hitching post, still out front in some cases. And the people I talked to all said the same thing. The store was where you found out who died. You didn't go there for news. You went there because the news was there.
The store as information infrastructure.
One old farmer told me the car killed the second-hand economy. He said, "We used to borrow a cup of sugar from the neighbor. Now we drive to Walmart." He wasn't being sentimental. He was describing a logistical fact. When everyone needed each other for rides and goods and labor, there was a whole web of exchange that didn't involve money. The car made it possible to buy your way out of needing anyone.
The car didn't just change where people shopped. It changed whether they needed each other at all.
That's what he said. The store was the center of it. Barter, credit, trade. You brought in eggs, you left with flour, and the storekeeper kept the ledger. Nobody had cash. The whole local economy ran on obligation. And the car made obligation unnecessary. You could just drive to the county seat and pay cash for whatever you needed.
The store as a clearinghouse for social debt. That's a whole way of life that just evaporated.
My grandmother lived in that same town. Never learned to drive. Born in 1902, died in 1989. The last 20 years of her life, she was effectively housebound. When the general store closed in the 60s, there was nothing within walking distance. No sidewalks on the county road. She couldn't get to church unless someone drove her. So she sat in the house and watched the cars go by.
The cars stranded the non-drivers. The people who were once integrated into the life of the town.
She used to walk to the store every day. That was her routine. Then the store closed, and the routine died with it. The car didn't just kill the store. It killed the walk to the store. And the walk was the community.
That's the detail I keep coming back to. The walk. The casual encounters that happened on foot. The car didn't eliminate community, but it eliminated the walk that community used to happen along.
The survey ended in August. I filed the report, turned in the keys. The county used it to apply for a historic preservation grant. I don't think they got it. The buildings are probably gone now. But I still have the photographs.
Where does that leave us? A century into the automobile age.
I keep thinking about the next century. The car reshaped rural America in a single century. What's the next transport revolution going to do? Autonomous vehicles, e-bikes, high-speed rail? If the car decentralized everything, do autonomous vehicles re-centralize it? Or do they just make the sprawl more efficient?
Remote work is already changing the calculus. If you don't have to commute, you can live farther out. But you still need to get to a grocery store. The built environment doesn't change as fast as the technology.
The question is whether we're locked in. The roads are built. The zoning is codified. The cultural habits are set. Can you retrofit a car-centric landscape into something more walkable, more connected, or are we stuck with this for generations?
I think the answer is that we can change it, but it's slow. Incremental. You add a sidewalk, you change a zoning code, you build a mixed-use development, and over decades, the landscape shifts. But the car isn't going anywhere. The future is probably some hybrid.
The paradox of community remains. We gained reach and lost depth. Is there a way to have both? The technology that connected us across distance also disconnected us across the street. Maybe the next century's challenge is figuring out how to rebuild the street without abandoning the distance.
That's the open question Daniel's prompt leaves us with. And it's a good one.
Before we go, one detail from the research that didn't fit anywhere else. The corduroy roads. Logs laid side by side across muddy ground. They were so rough that travelers sometimes preferred to drive alongside them in the dirt rather than on them. The name comes from the ridged texture, like corduroy fabric. Imagine your commute on that.
I'd rather not. But it does put the potholes in perspective.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed the show, leave us a review wherever you listen. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro. With text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.